Welcome to the Ancient Christian Writers series, led by Father David Abernethy at the Oratory of St. Philip Neri in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The following recording is a reading and discussion of the ascetical homilies of St. Isaac the Syrian. Our ability to provide podcasts free of charge is made possible by the generosity of listeners like you. If you would like to make a contribution in support of our ministries, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org. Your interest and prayerful support are appreciated. God bless you and enjoy the podcast.
Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back to the Ancient Christian Writers series. And we're picking up with our reading of St. Isaac the Syrian's ascetical homilies. And we're currently reading homily 64. And tonight we're picking up on page 450. So we've been taking our time relatively with this homily, even in comparison to some of the others, because of its richness and the path that he seems to lay out for us here for the spiritual life as a whole and the ascetical life. And in some ways, it's almost like an overview of what he's covered so far, as well as a rather lengthy section coming up on silence itself. So we're picking up about a quarter of the way down the page, or a third of the way down the page, with the paragraph beginning, "Love stillness far more than labors." And so in these couple paragraphs, he'll be talking about this, of course, stillness, psalmody, sorrow in the spiritual life, zeal versus lethargy, how we overcome one with the other, having a kind of good order in our day-to-day life and how this can contribute to the spiritual life as a whole, the importance of temperance, and then also a kind of wisdom that we need to have in our spiritual disciplines, so that we don't work ourselves into exhaustion, as it were, so that we would use discernment and not making ourselves ill, for example, through excessive vigils or fasting, that there would always be, sort of as in the mind and writings of Cassian, moderation would reign. And so again, about a third of the way down the page, "Love stillness far more than labors. Give more honor to reading, if possible, than to standing, for it is a source of pure prayer. But do not neglect standing entirely, and be on alert against mental wandering. Psalmody is the root of the ascetic discipline." So already here in the first couple of sentences that he throws together, there's quite a bit here, but he's trying to sort of establish a pattern of thought for us here and the weight that we give to certain practices and that we would want to have deeply ingrained within us so that we, as we are engaged in the spiritual life and we find ourselves perhaps struggling with one thing or another, we might understand what might be the more appropriate course for us. If we find ourselves distracted, for example, spiritual reading might be the thing to hold on to in order to help us regain our focus, or again to establish a kind of zeal within our heart for the spiritual life. But love stillness far more than labors. And so, you know, we've talked about this quite a bit, that there is a kind of emphasis that we have in our lives on action and activity building, and we can approach the spiritual life in a similar kind of way, an activism, externalize things, or even in terms of devotions, things such as that, rather than cultivating a kind of stillness where we might be able to listen to God on a deeper level. Stillness allows for a kind of internal stillness to begin to emerge, deep silence where we can listen to God as he speaks to us and makes his will known to us. And so above all, this is what we would want to cling to, and then so also avoid the things that would steal our peace and the stillness and silence from us, so that we would seek to simplify our lives to remove those things that are typically, I think, the daily distractions for us tonight. or not tonight, but I was jumping ahead in my thought. See, I think so quickly. I was one thought ahead. No. Tonight we were talking at dinner a little bit about this, how what's going on in the church throughout the world is so immediately present to us that it's often difficult for us to become detached from that or to remain focused and attached to the things that really strengthen us in the spiritual life. That there's a tendency for anxiety to pervade our thoughts when we hear about potential schisms or things that the Pope is saying, or what's going on in Germany, or what's going on in India is the most recent thing, and that these things cause a kind of anxiety for us. And Isaac, as we read him, would be certainly telling us, I think, to avoid such things at all cost, that we would have a trust in the providence of God to the extent that we wouldn't have to imagine that our thinking obsessively about these things is somehow going to change them, and or that our talking about them or arguing about them on the internet is going to change them. That all of these can be sort of temptations for us to move away from the things that are most transformative for us, strengthen us, but then also strengthen the body of the church as a whole. And so if the evil one wants to distract us, he's going to pull us into things that fill us with anxiety or fill us with anger. Give more honor to reading, if possible, than to standing, for it is a source of pure prayer. So standing would be a kind of spiritual discipline when one would be praying or saying the Psalms, and often prostrations would go along with that. But greater honor, he's saying, than this physical discipline would be something that would involve more of an internal discipline that comes through our reading, and particular kinds of readings, as we heard last time, not things that are overly theological or, again, that are going to become a kind of distraction for us, but those that are going to inflame our desire for God, our hunger for prayer, that these are the things that we would want to give most honor to, that we would turn back to them again and again to be nourished upon them, that spiritual reading can nourish us far more than the discipline of standing to say prayer. That certainly has its value for us. It helps us to be more attentive, vigilant in our prayers. We can stay focused with a greater clarity. But certainly in comparison to reading, say, something like the Scriptures or St. Isaac the Syrian, that there's something that nourishes us in a very deep way here and remains with us that is far greater than the mere act of standing. But do not neglect standing entirely, and be on alert against mental wandering. So standing does, as I said, lead to a kind of vigilance. And this is something, again, that we're not very familiar with. I think we're typically familiar with sitting down in the pew and then after about 10 minutes falling asleep because it's so quiet and comfortable in the chapel. And so if we are to gain something here, it's the importance of posture. Kneeling might be more of, in the Western Church, the posture that we tend to gravitate towards than standing. So standing might feel sort of awkward to us to stand at the back of the church when we're praying or of adoration in order to remain vigilant. But we don't want to be a distraction to others. Kneeling can be a very powerful thing, as we heard last week, that if God gives us the grace and stills the heart through the practice of kneeling. If you remember, Isaac said, don't break off of it. Allow yourself to remain in that posture as long as possible, so long as the grace is given to us. And so similarly here with standing, that we would want to hold on to it, to keep our minds from wandering. And nothing helps the mind wander more than sleep, because we typically begin. I've had full-blown dreams within the chapel, so at times the depth of my contemplation is so great that I have like these three-part dreams during the. I've actually had an old guy come over and shake me by. This was quite a year or so ago. Shake me by the shoulder, to wake me up because evidently I was breathing pretty loudly. psalmody is the root of the ascetical discipline. So the Psalms always have spoken very deeply to the human heart. And I think when we look at them, they touch every kind of experience that we have as human beings, and as well as the sort of the movement of emotion that we experience in our life, sorrow, despondency, joy, anger, you know, anything that we might encounter spiritually comes forward to us from the Psalms. And there's something about them that speaks to the heart. And so they've always had, you know, pride of place, especially in monastic culture, that the monks would say, you know, of old would say all the Psalms in one day. I think now it's all the Psalms in the course of a week that they would say in regards to, is that right? Yeah, all the Psalms in a week that they would say as part of their divine office. And oftentimes they would have this memorized, so rich are they in terms of, again, inflaming the heart for God or being the vehicle to cry out to God in our times of need. Sometimes being able to take hold of another's words allows us then to make this movement towards God. And so often that's true in the Psalms. You know, the first couple words of a psalm are often enough to stir the heart. And so they are one of the great blessings for us in the ascetical life. And he says the root of ascetical discipline. So in so many ways, he's saying here that the Psalms really help us to establish the discipline of the life of faith, of turning to God in every circumstance, at every moment of our life, whatever we might be going through. So it becomes really the root of the spiritual and ascetical life for us. Know also that psalmody, when we're recited with a wandering mind, is more profitable than labor of body. So a curious thing, that even if we're struggling with a wandering mind, there's still something about praying the Psalms and struggling through that wandering mind with the Psalms that is greater than our labors. And that's important for us because I think it often when we are struggling with dissipation, where our thoughts are pulling us in multiple directions, we will want to move in the direction of doing something, to focus our attention by working and directing it upon something else rather than remaining in prayer. And so what he's telling us here is that don't let yourself get up and make that movement. Remain where you are and remain with the psalmody until the mind and the heart are stilled. That at times we have to allow the Psalms to carry us along in the same way that we would allow the rosary to do that for us, or the Jesus prayer. There are times where we're going to be so frustrated, angry, tired, despondent, that we have to sort of take hold of the prayer and lean into it and allow it to pull us forward. And Psalms certainly are very powerful in this regard. Sorrow of mind is superior to bodily toil. It's not a very attractive thought. Sorrow of mind is superior to bodily toil. So contrition, compunction, that we would experience in the face of a clear-sighted view of our own sin is of greater value to us than the toils and labors that we might engage in. That this is the this is what begins to move us toward God and toward the healing that we desire. When we experience that deep contrition, sorrow, mourning, if you will, and even the tears that often follow that this is what draws us to the place of mercy. And so it's always, again, going to be greater than any kind of bodily toil that we might engage in, including something like fasting. You know, that compunction of heart is going to lead to that interior movement that is most needed, and that even fasting is meant to contribute to through the humbling of the mind and body. And we've talked a good bit about this, you know, sorrow of mind and compunction, that it always, the end of it is always joy for us, because it's, if it's true, if it's rooted in repentance, it's always going to lead us toward God, not back into ourselves or closing in on ourselves or into despondency. True compunction is going to acknowledge the pain of our sin, the breakdown of that relationship, but it's going to lead us back to where we need to be. Sort of like the story of the prodigal son. We are brought to that point of acknowledging our deep poverty, and his deep poverty redirects him back to the Father. And in a similar way, the poverty of our sin and seeing it, what we're often reduced to because of it, is something that leads us into the arms of God. It's a difficult thing in our day and age, because I think some of the things that we struggle with, and so many struggle with, leads to deep shame. And we've talked about this before, that the sort of the curse of our time is pornography, but it's the pornography that's available through the internet and accessible, and even to, you know, young people as young as 12 years old, often they're on the internet. So from that very early age, there's a kind of addiction or habitual practice of looking at these images. It becomes a passion and so deeply rooted that even when it makes them sick and they don't want it in their life, that they can't break the grasp of it. And so the words here of Isaac become very important. The sorrow of mind, but the sorrow of mind that would be compunction that leads us to God, the one who's going to ever be the source of mercy for us, but also hope, the one who can break us free from that bondage that perhaps has existed for decades. And, I have the opportunity to talk to a lot of people, and often it is the disconnect from the spiritual tradition. That in the East, we've talked about this before, that the church is seen as a hospital, and the spiritual fathers, you know, are often the ones who, through experience, know the medicine, as it were, the remedies to apply to the things that affect us and afflict us the most. And yet we are so disconnected from that tradition that what often is given is sort of a smattering of the spiritual tradition, various writers, what they say, or certain practices that a person might engage in. But when you're talking about passions that have become deeply rooted over the course of 2, 3, 4 decades of a person's life, something less than St. Isaac, or something less than the ascetic tradition as a whole, and that arises, you know, not simply through reading, but with the help of an experienced guide, nothing less than that is going to be helpful for a person to find hope in God again, but to be able to step into that struggle with a sense of what comes to us from the wisdom of the fathers. How did they deal with these appetites that we have as human beings, especially appetites that are so deeply touched by sin? And in particular, this kind of appetite, you know, that is rooted in our bodily desires, part of us as a human being, that it often seems insurmountable once it, takes hold of a person. So, you know, what is it that can free a person, you know, both in terms of prayer life, ascetical life, life of fasting? Where does one begin to focus and allow that hope in God and His grace to be renewed? Yes.
What would you say to someone? I could imagine someone saying, you know, the fathers in the field of temptation that you're talking about, which particularly grips people today, it seems, and unfortunately young people. What would you say to someone who says, you know, the fathers lived so long ago, they really didn't have the temptations that modern man has before him today? And there's some truth, there's a lot of truth to that, just given the presence of the internet, given the accessibility of these things, that there weren't. And you might be tempted to think, you know, the fathers aren't going to help me because they really don't understand what I'm dealing with.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I think when I begin talking with people, it's usually about the that this isn't, what we're talking about here isn't strictly a spiritual kind of discipline, that asceticism isn't tied only to religion. Ascetical is a human reality. You know, asceticism means to exercise. And so to exercise the faith, to engage in a spiritual discipline, is very much akin to our exercise of disciplines in every other field of our life. And so it's a very human reality here that they are facing, and what they do in other areas of their life, and even what they admire in other people who engage in it so fully, athletes, academics, artists, that this is what we are called to in the spiritual life, that part of being a human being is struggling with these realities and struggling towards that perfection in any given area. And that would be true within the spiritual life, to be perfected in humility, purity, love of God. How does one go about that? And so, you know, I think when you can sort of attach it to the basic human element of it, where it doesn't seem so esoteric or archaic, you know, rooted in these practices or writings of, you know, men who lived, you know, centuries ago, but is very much a part of our day-to-day life and even something that they've experienced. And then when you begin to examine that which afflicts, and even to talk about some of the remedies that come from the fathers, you see a kind of light bulb go on. And it's not that it's very difficult to understand in that regard, because it's very human. You know, I think intuitively, when we step back and look at these things, we can understand them, how it is that we enter into that battle. But the problem is it's never been spoken of, or it's such a jumble and so inconsistent, or just not talked about at all, that I think a lot of people feel lost. It's sort of the image from the gospel, you know, Christ looking out, you know, with compassion at the crowds. They're like sheep without a shepherd. And, you know, there's that one section of the gospel where he's moved at the sight of it. You know, he shakes at the sight of it, because the image is not, you know, just sheep wandering around or abandoned, but it's actually sheep that have been mauled by the predators, so torn apart upon the fields. And, you know, Christ sees this and is moved to the depths of his being. And I think we sort of have to have that same visceral experience in our own life, you know, that we see our own struggles, but we see struggles within the life of the church, that people are being torn apart by, you know, so many things that attack and afflict them, and that are being used against them by the evil one to dismantle their relationship with God and to destroy their hope. And this has touched every aspect of the life of the church. You know, it's not only lay people, but it's, you know, bishops, priests, downward. Well, you know, how do we think all this happened other than a radical disconnect from the spiritual tradition of the church that's rooted in the gospel? You know, it's the life of the church has become, you know, very worldly in that regard, and, you know, that often run like a business more than like a hospital, a place of healing, spiritual healing. I don't know if that addresses your question, but hopefully we'll be able to approach it more as we go along. In a period of lethargy, be vigilant and stir up your zeal a little, for zeal greatly awakens the heart and inflames the thoughts of the soul. Just as natural anger is a help against lust, so it is also in a time of lethargy, because it melts coldness of soul. Lethargy usually comes upon us from one of these reasons, either from an overladen stomach or from exhaustion caused by works. So it's interesting, you know, he's speaking here about anger in a way that we typically wouldn't speak about anger, as being something helpful and actually essential within the spiritual battle. So often we can be too passive, as it were, when we're engaged in the spiritual life, and we often fail to see it for what it is, a spiritual battle, a spiritual warfare that is going on. And so when there is a lack of zeal, when there's a kind of lethargy that comes over us, this anger, he says, can stir that zeal again, a kind of hatred for sin and what it does to us. And if you remember, often in the past we've talked about the various faculties of the soul that the fathers talked about. And one of the faculties is the insensitive faculty, from which we get our word incensed. And it's what allows us to see and identify sin as it approaches or temptation as it approaches, and then to react with a kind of swiftness. That anger often reveals to us something that is wrong, a kind of injustice, if only injustice towards God and to what he's created. And so our response should be swift and quick and fierce, in the sense that as a temptation comes, we would swiftly cut it off rather than communing with it, as it were, and sitting down and chatting with it. You know, there is a sense that we have to very quickly engage in the battle in order to set it aside. That the Jesus prayer has often been used in connection with the image of a sword, sort of cutting away temptations as they come to us. And the image that is often used is a serpent's head, that'll often be the temptation or the demon approaching. And you want to slam shut the door as quickly as possible before the head of the serpent gets in, because once the head is in, the whole body follows quickly before you're able to stop it. And, you know, they use all kinds of images like this, you know, the dashing, you know, the image from the Psalms, you know, dashing the heads of infants against the rocks. And, you know, the fathers were the first to sort of take up that image from the Psalms that horrifies everybody when they hear it, and it often removes it from, you know, certainly any liturgical use because of the strength of the image. But it's so important for us spiritually to hold on to that, because they saw that in terms of temptation, that there would be a fierceness and relentlessness with which we would fight that battle, because the evil one is relentless and fierce in that battle. And similarly, you know, the growth of a tree or sapling, as we've talked about before, that if it's a sin that's taking root, that we would want to rip it out, roots and all, right from the beginning, rather than allowing it to grow and put down deep roots to the point that we're incapable of freeing ourselves from it. We're incapable of uprooting it no matter what we try to do. You know, then it's only by, you know, a great miracle that would happen. And so, you know, this, what he's saying here, I think, you know, if you were to take one thing away, perhaps tonight, that's very important, it would be this, because I think it's the often neglected aspect of the spiritual life, the insensitive faculty and the import that it has in doing battle with our sins. Two reasons, either overladen stomach. So gluttony is the first on the list of the eight vices or the capital sins. East or west, gluttony is always the first. You know, the bodily appetite, if not restrained and ordered, leads to a weakening of our strength and the strength of our will in regards to other bodily appetites. And so to fill our bellies to the point of excess or of richness, you know, it brings upon us a kind of lethargy, not only in body, but in mind. And at that point, we become much more vulnerable to the attack of temptations, you know, that we aren't as vigilant in our prayer as we are when, you know, we've taken only what's necessary for our sustenance. And again, maybe that this is part of the reason why lust is such a big part of our culture, or why it has developed as such a big part of our culture, is because of how unrestrained we are in regards to our eating. that the abundance that we have gained over the course of the generations, that often the shock to foreigners when they come to our country is to walk into, the biggest shock is to walk into a grocery store because of the enormous selection there. It's almost overwhelming to their senses to walk through a grocery store because they've never seen so much food in one place. And over the course of time, you know, the quantity of our meals have grown that we throw out more than people used to eat in the past. I remember I traveled to Rome with my dad once, and you know, we sat down, you know, for dinner, and in fact we had to come back later because we did the whole American thing of going to dinner like at 5:30. I said, we're not open yet. Yeah, you have to come back like a couple hours later and we'll hold a table for you. But it's interesting, you know, the portion of, especially like of meat for them is very, very modest in comparison to what we have here. Is like it's, you know, five people could eat, you know, what we typically would. And so we've become accustomed to seeing that as, or having that as an expectation, that portion is as important as, you know, the quality of the food, and even more important, you know, that we have enough to really stuff ourselves to the gills. And, you know, a lot of people's favorite holiday is Thanksgiving, where we just sort of like gorge ourselves and watch football and fall asleep. You know, it's sort of our special Thanksgiving tradition. So it's built into our culture. So how do we back away from that? If we know that food intake and disorder there, in particular with gluttony, leads then to a vulnerability with lust, you know, how do we then, within our own lives, begin to pull back on that? How do we begin to take up the practice of fasting on as a regular aspect of our spiritual life? And we've talked before that for us in the West in particular, it really can be limited to 2 days a year, Ash Wednesday and Good Friday, for a lot of Western Christians. Often it's not thought of other than those 2 days, and in those 2 days we're told, you know, have one small meal and two small meals and one regular meal. Well, that's not fasting. If you're eating, even if it's a small meal, you're breaking the fast. So I don't know who came up with that nutty idea, but it's, you know, it certainly has nothing to do with the spiritual tradition. And it is something meant to be regular, and it's only in that regularity that our body adjusts to it, but we also begin to see the spiritual fruit of it, why it's so valuable. It's one thing for us to read about it here in Isaac and even see how closely it is connected then to lust, but it's only through experience where we struggle with our own appetites and we link the ascetical practice of fasting to prayer that we begin to see how the two mutually strengthen each other. And so if you're thinking about looking at your prayer role and your spiritual resolutions, you know, certainly fasting would be a good one. There's a good book called To Love Fasting. I think one of the better works that I've ever read in terms of focusing upon the history and the development of fasting, the regular fast, but also the sort of the pitfalls, the difficulties of it, spiritual fruits, but then the physiological aspects of it too, even in terms of when the hunger pangs cease for us. You know, it's the best work I've ever read in that regard, you know, in the sense of laying out fasting and how it can be practiced, and how it can even be practiced in the world, you know, that there is a gradual movement towards that without the weakening of one's body, that we can really function on one meal a day and be healthy. You know, the whole thing about three meals a day and even like six, eating six times a day, that's all you know, arises out of the medical community, and but really, it's a farce, you know, in the sense of the impact upon our health. And probably, you know, I think it's even, you know, they're finding more and more, I think people even in the secular culture are engaging in this intermittent fasting, that they've discovered the health benefits of it. And so all of a sudden it's become in vogue to do this. And you're thinking, gee, you know, those in the world are taking it up and doing it. And here we are as Christians, we neglect it altogether when we're being told this is really the beginning of the spiritual battle for ourselves. Okay? The other is from exhaustion caused by works. And so again, you know, he'll talk about this a little bit later on, but there has to be a kind of measuredness in this, as there is in any other discipline too, that we can work ourselves to the point of exhaustion and then make ourselves vulnerable. Not just to, you know, a physical kind of breakdown, but we can make ourselves so fatigued that we become then vulnerable to temptation, because we lose our vigilance, we're so fatigued, or we become vulnerable to pride, you know, that we are pushing ourselves so hard that the ascetical practice becomes an end in itself. And so we begin to admire ourselves in the act of engaging in a given practice. And so both of these aspects of exhaustion are to be avoided.
But sorry, are they only talking about ascetical works here, or are they talking about being overworked in general?
Overworked in general can be a temptation for us too. There's a story of a monk who was, you know, chopping wood, and he began to think to himself, well, if I spent more time cutting that wood throughout the day, then I could sort of build up a supply of firewood for a period of time, and so that I could have greater leisure later on. And another holy monk walks by while this is going on, and he sees a demon sort of driving him to engage in this labor, because the whole purpose is to convince him, you know, just what he was thinking, you know, that I should extend my work period, you know, for these specific gains, thinking that I'll be able to get other spiritual gains from doing so, but it's a delusion. And so what he does is he wears himself out and then becomes incapable of engaging in his spiritual life, which is the more important aspect than labor. And you know, certainly I think that's a struggle for us too. You know, our identity so often comes from pushing ourselves to the brink of exhaustion, that we feel that we've accomplished something, that to sit in prayer or to do spiritual reading or to, you know, foster silence and stillness often doesn't satisfy us intellectually and emotionally. You know, it doesn't offer that immediate kind of satisfaction that, you know, cutting a whole cord of wood would do for us. But he had to point out to this monk, you know, that you're being driven by a demon here, you know, to engage in these labors in excess. And we see similar things in the gospel too, you know, sort of the man who is the building of the barns. You know, I know what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, you know, to store these things for myself. And then he ends up dying that night.
It's so interesting because the comment on, like, fathers and it being relevant then for today, because, like, I read this and it like describes our country so much, because like even at the beginning of it, lethargy, like I heard a year ago on or something on the news about how they were ranting on about how the new thing that the wealthy elite were stealing from the rest of us was our sleep. And but then you go into it, like, right, like only the wealthy have enough time or something to sleep or whatever it was. And then you get into this whole thing, and it's like we work so hard from a young age just to, like, right, like first you're working to get into a college, then into a good job, and that good job is usually like something that's overworks you so that you can, I don't know, be comfortable until you die. Like, that's essentially what retirement becomes, you know, like, it's like this lifelong plan of comfort, and you're like working yourself, you're exhausting yourself this whole time, and then like that lethargy, it gets to an absurd point where the news is talking about how the wealthy are stealing sleep from people, you know, like, it's just, I don't know, I guess it seems like abundantly relevant to me.
Yeah, retirement's always a curious thing. Sort of as you said, you know, because you work very hard all those years, you know, but then at 65 you retire, and I think the, what dad's saying all the time, like sitting on the deck all day waiting for the check to come in or something like that, you know, I can't remember what that song is. Sitting on the porch.
Waiting for the checks to come in.
Yeah, you know, it's, he loved retirement, by the way, but... But I think when we think of the spiritual life, you know, retirement for us or recreation for us isn't seen through the same lens, that there is always this, would be a growing and developing asceticism over the course of time. Not in the sense that we are adding one thing on another to the point, you know, that we, again, sort of crush ourselves by the time we're an old man, but that there's a kind of perfecting of that practice and attentiveness to what we are doing, and then the fruit of that begins to grow so that there's greater intimacy with God, but also greater freedom from the passions. And there's no retirement from that. We've already heard Isaac tell us that you know, in regards to the spiritual life, there is no Sabbath. The Sabbath day for us is the grave. And so, you know, it doesn't fit with our secular notion, you know, of how we often treat the Sabbath, which often has nothing to do with God, but sort of a zoning out and, you know, putting out of our mind the work of the week, and freeing ourselves from that in some form or fashion. It should really be a deeper engagement there that restores this mind, body, and spirit. Yes?
After, for me, because I kind of lost the like immediate relevance of this thought, but it's something that came to mind when you were talking about like the serpent in the door and taking hold of temptations and fighting against them. And I was like, you know, kind of thinking to myself, I was so struck. So I looked up this thing that you posted 2 days ago, that just like struck me so much, talking about thoughts and images. And at the second half of it, he says, for fighting against the thoughts of things, it's much harder than fighting against the things themselves. Justice to sin in the mind is easier than to sin through outward action. And that's St. Maximus the Confessor. And I was so struck by that because I don't think it's often I don't think we often think of it that way. I think we feel like we've accomplished some enormous thing when we don't act out sins anymore. We're like, well, I'm not committing adultery, I'm not engaging in these lustful activities, I'm not saying harmful things to others or gossiping. And then like we have this illusion like, oh, I hate temptation, I hate it so much. But like, how hard are we really fighting? And it's not even because like, yeah, to be tempted kind of feels good. It's like, you know, the temptation itself is already this action, is the sin already taking root in the mind, which is really the sin already taking place in the thoughts. And I've been thinking about that a lot lately, like how much of the passions is acted out in the thoughts, and how much that's where the sin itself is taking place, and how little of a victory it is just not to like be doing the things you're thinking. Like, that's not really that big of a deal. Like, well, good for you, but it's like, what are you contemplating doing? What do you want to do? Like, what's like all there, like in your thoughts and in your heart and in your desires and all these things? And it's like, yeah, you can physically restrain yourself from acting them out, but like,
right. And I don't even think it gets to that level of consciousness in the sense of not even committing particular sins. You know, I think for most, we're just unaware of what's going on, you know, internally, you know, in the sense that they would be talking about, that the battle is essentially psychological. You know, it's within the mind and within the heart, with one's thoughts, as we've often talked about, the logismoi. And so, we're, you know, Paul talks about taking every thought captive, that this is where the warfare often takes place, you know, being aware, vigilant, watchful of what's going on within the mind and the heart and the subtle movement of temptation, which might be very benign at first, you know, sort of coaxing us to let down that guard or to engage in a certain activity or certain conversation, you know, or to gaze at something or to watch something, you know, and we don't pay it any mind until we're drawn further into it. And by that time, we might even just be completely oblivious to it altogether because we rationalize on top of everything else the idea that it's okay, you know, I'll just fast forward through these things or whatever it might be. And so we allow ourselves a kind of leeway, you know, where we're, you know, going to be very vulnerable. And so the battle does have to be, there has to be, again, this kind of intensity, the intensive power, not only against certain actions or the obvious sins, but the things that are far more subtle. And the vigilance, you know, the watchman has to be incredibly vigilant to see these subtle movements. And it's only when we have moved to that kind of internal stillness that that watchfulness becomes very intense. The more distracted we are, the less stillness and silence there is in our life, then the more vulnerable we're going to become. Because we're going to be surrounded by so many different things, it becomes very difficult to distinguish. You know, what is a temptation? What is not? What should I avoid? You know, is this from God, or is it, you know, from myself and my own desires, or is it from the evil one?
It really does drive home when Christ says, like, to lust after another person is to have already committed adultery with them. Like, in your heart, I feel like we hear that, and it's like, well, yeah, but I didn't.
Right.
And it's like, no, you did. Like as if there's something so vastly less real about what's going on within the mind and the heart than what is being done with the body.
Yeah. Well, out, what's the phrase? Out of the heart, the mouth speaks.
Out of the fullness of the heart.
Right. And so, you know, those Freudian slips really aren't like slips. You know, they're not like, they're not accidents. They come from someplace, and typically deep from within the unconscious. And, you know, sometimes we'll couch them in humor, you know, and or laugh about these things, but often it's, you know, can reveal what's really going on within, you know, what's said in an unguarded moment, or what comes out, you know, the word that comes out that we didn't mean to come out, but it's really what we did mean because it's what we're thinking, you know, deep within, or emerges from deep within us. And so it becomes very important for us to be attentive to those things. You know, they can sort of reveal what is far more subtle for us. Even our dreams do that as well. Not that we need to analyze our dreams, you know, and sometimes there can be certain dangers in doing that depending on the nature of them, but they can reveal, you know, what is deep within the heart, what is deep within the unconscious, that even if externally we aren't engaging in certain behaviors and practices, it's still deep within the heart, the desire, the passion can have a hold on us, our attachment to certain sins. And often they will only emerge, and sometimes even emerge in this way that is highly altered by the mind, you know, because our defenses come into play. So, you know, that's why your dreams are so crazy sometimes, because our minds really don't want to look at the full truth. So it alters them, alters certain aspects of what comes forward, and to protect us, because if we knew what we were probably thinking half the time, we'd be horrified, you know. And But the deeper we go, the more the mind moves into the heart, the deeper the stillness becomes, the more much of that begins to emerge from within us. We begin to see it with a greater clarity. This is why, you know, the young monks would reveal all of their thoughts to their elders, because it's in those thoughts that the elder could get a sense of what they were struggling with. And we do something similar in frequent confession. You know, we bring forward the things that we struggle with. But we could probably enter into that practice in a way that maybe is shaped a little bit more in the way that we see that practice of the fathers, of really looking at what's going on, you know, deep within us. You know, what are the thoughts, the feelings that we are struggling with, as well as, you know, certainly the overt actions, but to be much more attentive to what's going on within. Okay, what time do we have here? 20 after, so we've got 10 full minutes here. We could squeeze a lot into that. Good order in one's labor is a light to the understanding. There's nothing like knowledge. Let every prayer that you offer in the night be more precious in your eyes than all your activities of the day. Do not weigh down your belly, lest your mind become confused and be troubled with mental wandering when you stand up at night, unless your members be enervated and you find yourself filled with womanish languor. Sorry, ladies.
What is
languor?
Languor.
It's sort of like, yes.
Imagine a chaise lounge.
Yeah. an unmanly fear. An unmanly fear, you know, I think Climacus would call it. And, you know, it's, you know.
I'm fine with that language.
Yeah. So, you know, what I think, yeah, we would want to read it in that way, you know, just in the way that we would read that paragraph before, that we have to be willing to enter into the battle. And that does require a certain level of courage and, you know, understanding that the battle is going to be fierce. And so we can't be lax or, you know, hang back, you know, because the moment that we do that is when we're going to be mortally wounded. And so we want to have this, we want to avoid the unmanly fear, to be fully engaged in it. But going back to the beginning, good order in one's labor is a light to the understanding. So, you know, having a kind of order to our life, our spiritual life, our work, all these things is a kind of light to the understanding. You know, when we commit ourselves to a particular role, you know, when our life becomes scattered externally, it often becomes scattered and disorganized internally as well. You know, there's that phrase, like a clean desk is a sign of a sick mind. Well, it's probably somebody with a sick mind who said that, you know, or a sick life. You know, it's the reality is that a kind of ordered life does help us then set aside the things that are unnecessary, not just our attachments, but the things that are sort of distractions, and to become focused on what we're doing and the matter at hand. And so having a kind of order allows that to begin to emerge. And so even sort of looking more closely at the monastic life, the breaking of the day at certain times, you know, that allows a person to turn to God again and again, back into one's labor, back to prayer, that there's a kind of flow and order to that day, a movement in, you know, ora et labora. And there's a wisdom to that. It brings light to the understanding. It brings a kind of clarity about who we are as human beings, what brings us freedom, what it is that we struggle with. The order allows us to have a greater clarity in our vision about what's going on internally as well as around us. And so the more disordered and chaotic things are, we tend not to see sometimes the most important things begin to fall through the cracks. And so often the beginning of the spiritual life is developing a kind of simplicity, moving towards a simplicity in our life, cutting out things that may have seemed important, but crowd out that which is precious and more valuable. And so a willingness to clean house, as it were. There's nothing like knowledge. Let every prayer that you offer in the night be more precious in your eyes than all the activities of the day. It's sort of a peculiar thought, again. You know, every prayer you offer in the night more precious in your eyes than every thought during the day. You know, that our focus is often on, you know, what we're doing or accomplishing, you know, externally, our activities. You know, these in our minds have the greater value. But for the prayer, it's going to be those times of the day that allow for the deepest stillness and silence to emerge, and so the deepest prayer and intimacy with God. And so one would come to hold those moments is far more precious than anything that we might accomplish during the day, no matter how good it might be. If we understand that everything begins and ends with God, then we're going to understand that. You know, that our real strength, what leads us to the life of virtue, is the grace of God and God alone. And so we have to set aside the illusion, you know, that we can work our way, you know, simply through our labors, the labors of the day, to the life of Christ. You know, the transformation comes by the grace of God, and we seek to allow that and help that to happen as much as we can. Do not weigh down your belly, again, similar thought, lest your mind become confused and be troubled with mental wandering when you stand up at night, lest your members be enervated and you find yourself filled with womanish languor. So, you know, there's a tendency, and certainly I struggle with this as well, that often we become ravenous at night before bed. You know, that we'll develop a craving to eat something because it will help us sleep, you know, sleep deeper sometimes. You know, if we don't want to go to bed hungry. And so, you know, the idea of going to get a little snack or some ice cream or whatever will come to mind. But Isaac is telling us this on a spiritual level, this is actually the worst thing that we can do for ourselves in the sense of being able to rise at the night in the night in order to enter into that stillness. That even if we rise in the night, we're not going to be focused because, you know, of the full belly. Whereas if we, you know, ate only to the point of what we needed, sometimes that hunger even of itself allows us to wake. You know, we will sleep in such a way that we can wake and then engage immediately in our prayer. We're not so, you know, incapable of focusing because we're weighed down with food at that point. And again, this is something that perhaps we don't think of, you know, because that becomes, you know, the midnight snack is sort of like part of our common parlance, you know, that everybody knows what that is, and when you get cravings at night, and, you know, how that can taste extra good, you know, at that moment. And so it's, you know, this is one of those patterns that we have to step away from. Nay more, lest while your soul is darkened and your thoughts are turbid, you should not be able to collect your thoughts at all in your psalmody on account of that darkness. So the distraction, the weakness, the darkness all become so great that one can't, even with the help of the psalmody, pull the thoughts together. And further, lest the taste of all things should become insipid to you, and the verses chanted in your psalmody should hold no sweetness for you. That very psalmody, the variation of which your mind was wont to savor with delight through the acuteness and lucidity of your understanding. So a mind and heart dulled by the full belly is no longer going to be able to taste then the sweetness of the psalmody, you know, what the sweetness that God desires to give us. If we've replaced that with worldly kind of sweetness of food, if we filled ourselves with that, then we're not going to have we're going to lose our taste for the things of the kingdom. And this is part of what Isaac and the fathers try to foster, that we would develop that taste for the sweetness of prayer, the sweetness of silence, of virtue. This is why over and over again he's telling us, love stillness, love chastity, you know, love humility. You know, these we have to change the things around that we have affection for, desire, and hunger for in our day-to-day life. And this has to be fostered over and over again through the psalmody, through spiritual reading, and through engaging in prayer in a regular, prolonged way. And we won't go in it tonight because we're coming to the end, but the next section is prolonged stillness, that allowing ourselves to enter into prayer and stillness for a long period of time, you know, this allows us to begin to develop that taste for the sweetness of that intimacy with God. You know, we begin to long for it in our day-to-day life when we allow ourselves to have those periods where God draws us ever more deeply. So we've grown to a point where a lot of this will seem counterintuitive to us, you know, that we have to sort of stop ourselves, slow things down, read these things over and over again, but more important, put them into practice. Even if we fall away from it, you know, 100,000 times over, you know, we keep trying to embrace what he's talking about here. Okay. Any thoughts on these last couple paragraphs or the whole section that we read tonight? Yes.
I guess it just stands out. It's something I've been thinking about lately with, there's been more burial days lately. And so the traditional, like, weekly hymns, like the kind of the Ambrosian hymns, you know, when they talk about night and sleep, it's never positive. You know, there's real sense of, like, kind of fear and, you know, so Vespers hymns are always kind of like getting ready, you know, for that darkness is coming. Mm-hmm. And then in the morning, it's like trying to recover from it. So, you know, it really ties in here with this fear of lethargy. And it's kind of like you've said before about, you know, I forget who it comes from, that, you know, our Sabbath is when we're dead.
Right.
You know, it's like I think culturally we have this idea, we really feel like we deserve that sleep at night, that rest, you know, to really just kind of,
right,
you know, not worry about it, you know, just kind of, you know, almost to die at night a little bit, you know, and not have to care about things. But that seems to be quite the contrary of
right,
how someone like St. Isaac approached it.
We want to be wide awake and vigilant as possible, and especially during those times where the battle can be fiercest, you know, the fiercest with the demons, you know. And but you're right, you know, I think sleep almost becomes an escape for us rather than, you know, that nighttime being the time of vigilance, battle, or intimacy with God.
Well, Mary always said that everyone should sing the Te Luci Santi Terminum before bed, which is basically just like a prayer asking for God to, like, be a warrior and defend you in the battle of the coming darkness.
Yeah.
It's
right.
Really intense. So,
Did the fathers or do monks catch a nap during the day at all? Or is that not... I just wonder because if they are
not that they tell anybody about it, are we?
Yeah. I don't know. I just, like, is there that freedom built in at all, you know, during their day that they would be able to rest a bit if they are going to keep that
Actually, I think monks are far more attuned to, you know, sort of the patterns of life as a whole. And, you know, when there would be a need for sleep to avoid that exhaustion, and so might even be freer to give themselves that when needed. You know, but the emphasis isn't on that. You know, I think there's a desire to avoid what Isaac talks about here, the kind of lethargy that's brought on through exhaustion, but the emphasis is more on the vigilance that is needed. And so, you know, the Carthusians, you know, they'll break the night. They never like get a full night of 8 hours ever throughout the course of their life. You know, they maybe a couple hours and then they're up to pray, and maybe another couple of hours, but then they're up for morning prayer and mass and then work. You know, it's so, you know, I think, you know, we approach sleep very much like the other appetites, and we convince ourselves that, you know, we need so much of this or we're not going to be able to function in the way that we need to in order to do the things that we want or that the world tells us is important. Whereas I think the approach that comes to us from the spiritual tradition is that sleep is certainly needed in the same way as food is needed for our nourishment, but there needs to be a kind of order and discipline to that restraint of that appetite in order that we might be engaged in what is even more important, and that's the vigilance of the life of prayer. And so, you know, if a person's sleeping 10 hours a day, you know, they're either, you know, depressed and, you know, probably struggling with something there and might need to address it, or, you know, or there's a kind of negligence there on some level, a lack of discipline that allows them over time, you know, to get that down to a point where, you know, they can have more of their life dedicated to God.
I know this was just a little snapshot, you know, but subbing for, you know, Holy Hour this past weekend at 3, it was amazing how, you know, I went to bed for a few hours, came in for that hour, went home, went to sleep for a few more hours, got out, fine.
Right.
You know, I thought, there was a time when I did it for a couple of years, and then I don't do it anymore, but I thought, it's very doable. You know, sometimes maybe it's even the frame of mind that this is what I'm doing, this is going to be beautiful, I'll come home.
Yeah.
You know, and it won't.
Well, I think once you've tasted that, you begin to see the sweetness of it, and that you begin to see, okay, there's a discipline to this, and I have to have a kind of prudence in the way that I engage in it, so that I do have enough rest, you know, for my station in life and all the things that I do. But there's a value to this that it makes it worthwhile to take these times, to have these vigil hours, and that there's a sweetness to them like no other. And it's hard because the world around us will question it, you know, why would you want to do that? Or what's the value of that? Or aren't you going to be exhausted the next day? And that goes on in our own mind, too, you know, that somehow we aren't going to be able to function if humbled in mind and body. And sometimes the fatigue makes us pray with, you know, even greater vigor, and we, you know, become more attentive, you know, to ourselves as a person, as a whole, and so much more attentive to what's going on around us, surprisingly.
I heard before that John Paul II, because he was a pope, so busy days, I imagine, from that, but I mean, he was also always going, right? I mean, like, I've just heard things where he could be reading 2 books at once in the back of a car on the way to something. Like, I don't know how you read 2 books at once, but... but he would, even he, somebody caught his schedule or something before and asked him, like, you know, when do you sleep? Or you don't sleep, how do you have the energy to do it? Because he only slept 4 hours a night. And, but because he'd wake up the other 4 hours and he'd pray. I don't know how it was broken out, but, you know, he slept 4 hours and he said something like, there's more to being rested than bodily rest and sleep. Like, that he, you know, you can get all the sleep you need in the world and none of the time spent for prayer.
Right. And feel exhausted.
And have no rest. Yeah.
Yeah.
And be completely
right.
Exhausted.
That's right.
St. Catherine of Siena, who had supposedly had an infused knowledge of the fathers, of the desert fathers, I think she said that the hardest thing for her to give up, of course she had extraordinary gifts that were beyond nature and were given for to help, you know, to build up the church, but so she didn't have to eat. But she said the most difficult thing for her to do was to give up sleep.
Right.
So I think she basically didn't sleep.
Which I wouldn't recommend for everybody. I'll repeat that. I don't recommend that for everybody. That's right. But I think what Daniel said is great, that there's more, you know, to being rested than just the bodily rest. You know, it's the resting of the mind, but the heart, and the resting in God that strengthens us in ways that we often don't imagine until we've tasted something of the sweetness of the vigils or rising early, you know, for prayer.
Sometimes you can experience that, though, going to adoration. Before you go, you're tired, you're worn out, you're thinking, well, should I just go home? And then you go, it might be, you know, half an hour or the last few minutes, but you can come out of the chapel feeling very, very refreshed, or more refreshed if you would have gone home and taken an hour nap.
Okay. Why don't we stop there tonight? As always, in the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you.
Yes,
may Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Go in peace.
Thanks be to God.
Thank you all.
Thanks, Father.